Welcome to the Smichael Speaks podcast. This is the space and the place for leadership learning. I'm Joanne Smichael. I'm a speaker, an educator, a consultant, and a forever student of the world. Enjoy this episode. Dr. Will Manti, clinical neurologist at the University of Minnesota, is back with me today, and we're going to spend more time on brain matters. Welcome back, Will.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Now, the last time you were here, we talked about the types of dementia, how you diagnose it, and some of these new treatments with amyloids and all this other scientific stuff. It was interesting. If you're listening and you have not heard that episode, you need to, because it is very enlightening. You also shared your story of becoming a researcher and a clinician who focuses on this type of disease. Today, I really want to talk about prevention, whether brain disease can be prevented, and I want to talk about your specific research. I hope we can get to at least those two things today. Tell me, can it be prevented, and how?
Yeah. So maybe I'll discuss the cases that sort of can't be prevented, or at least we don't think can be prevented by really anything in our control. So there is a form of dementia where someone inherits a very powerful gene from their mom or dad, and essentially no matter what they do in their life, they will develop the disease. That being said, there are rare exceptions where we're finding people with those very powerful genes that somehow have been resistant to their effect. There was one publication of a man who had one of these very powerful genes, and he was in, I believe it was his 60s. Don't quote me on that. It could have been his 70s even. But this is a mutation that you normally develop the disease in your 40s. And he had worked in a essentially a very hot location his whole life. And I believe it was in a the ship quarters where the engine room was. And it was thought that maybe high temperatures, which can change the type of proteins that your body expresses, was protective against this very powerful mutation. That's very much just a hypothesis right now. We don't really know too much. But suffice to say that there are these very powerful mutations that can more or less guarantee that you're going to develop one of these dementias that we really can't do anything about unless if we're talking about these very rare circumstances. That being said, much of dementia actually can be prevented. So that's the good news. We know that rates of Alzheimer's disease have actually been declining. In terms of the per capita incidence of dementia, and we think it's because people are better able to control heart disease. So when we think about dementia risk factors, one recurring theme is that heart health is brain health. So going back to one thing we talked about our last episode, your brain has 400 miles of blood vessels in it. Again, most of these blood vessels are very tiny, very susceptible to wear and tear of things like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and diabetes. And so if you can do things in early life and midlife, like exercise, make sure that you are taking care of any high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, you can markedly decrease your future risk for dementia. Even if you carry, let's say, a genetic predisposition to the disease. So there was actually a recent study done in Bolivian indigenous populations in the Amazon who had very strong genetic risk factors for Alzheimer's, but there was no link between people that carried these risk factors and the actual rates of dementia. And it was thought that it was because these are people who are extremely physically active their entire lives. So most of us, are including myself, we're desk jockeys in a lot of ways. We kind of are at the desk and at the computer, and we really struggle to fit in our 15, 20 minutes of aerobic exercise a day like we're supposed to. But the long story short is if you can exercise, it really can have a profound impact on your future risk for dementia. And that goes not only for what we call vascular dementia, which is the type of dementias when your blood vessels start to peter out and die, but there's a link between vascular health and Alzheimer's disease. So it also applies to Alzheimer's disease. The other more rare types of dementias, we don't really have enough information on, but there's, no theoretical reason why exercise and control of heart health should also work. There's also several newer risk factors that are starting to be more well known. So air pollution is has become more well studied, and we know that people that are exposed to high levels of fine particulate matter, for instance, are at elevated risk of developing dementia. Hearing loss and vision loss. So if you're not able to see things and hear things, it's obvious that you're not going to be able to remember things as well. But there's also thought to be a response in your brain where if your brain is no longer getting signals, it kind of more or less no longer, does that role. It might be taken up into a different role, doing something else, and that may affect how you're able to remember, verbal information that's given to you or visual information that's given to you. So long story short is that vision loss and hearing loss, those are important things to try to prevent and also try to treat. So hearing aids, for instance, I always emphasize hearing aids. That's become a big area recently that if you have hearing loss, wearing hearing aids can have a huge effect on preventing your future risk for dementia. Things like head trauma, the most well-known example of that are NFL football players, who are, more or less, having repetitive head blows on a daily, weekly basis for decades of their life. Those people are at much higher risk of developing dementia in the future. And then I'll stop at the last one. There are more, but I'll stop at the last one that we're starting to understand more about what we put into our digestive system. What we put into our stomachs and into our intestines. There could be good stuff, but bad stuff too. There was a recent publication looking at people who lived within a mile of a golf course. And if the golf course shared the water supply that the person was drinking, that person was at double the risk of Parkinson's disease. And of course, this is not a causative relationship. This is an association. This is not proving any cause. And the study tried to control for things like age and medical risk factors and income and education. So try to control for things that could bias that relationship. But that risk of doubling the risk of Parkinson's disease still held. And one of the hypotheses is that a lot of golf courses used to use pesticides, and pesticides may increase your risk for neurodegenerative disease. We have more information now on Agent Orange, used in Vietnam. Very powerful defoliating agent, and veterans who are exposed to Agent Orange have a higher risk of neurodegenerative disease. So yeah, there's a lot of risk factors out there that we really don't understand too much, or maybe we're starting to understand just a little bit. I think one major problem of understanding these risk factors in the environment is that there's so many of them out there, and everyone has a different set of life experiences. It's very hard to run kind of our typical scientific experiment where we have two more or less identical people and one person gets the intervention and one person doesn't. You can't really do that in these types of environmental studies. You have to have more creative techniques to try to parse out the relationship. But it's definitely worth looking into because there are, again, emerging toxins in the environment that we think are bad and that can increase our future risk of dementia.
It's interesting. So there are actually kind of segments or portions of the population that are more likely to get dementia than others, or who have higher dementia risks than other. That's interesting. That's very interesting. So you are researching dementia in Native American populations, correct? So tell me about your research.
So it's really thanks to what should I say, my mentors who got me to where I am today. Much of that research, mu much sorry, much of that research and mu much of the runway that I talked about, where you kind of want to set up your research and apply to NIH, was trust building. A lot of Native populations have been unfortunately subject to abuse, whether it's from research teams in the past or treaties that have not been followed. I'm not an expert in that area, but trust has been broken. And it's something that took us several years to try to basically be there in person, have community-facing events, have barbecues. I will say to people who ask me, how do I get into this area? I think one important thing to mention is that it really matters to be a person before you are a doctor or before you're a researcher. A lot of medical talks, they start with, this is, Dr. So and so. Again, give their credentials, give their titles, give their, and I've been told by my mentors who've really made this possible. Start with who you are. That's what people want to know. They want to know, like, is this someone that we want to work with? I talk about, again, where I grew up and talk about my family and talk about some of my hobbies. And then after that, kind of, okay, like, we've established a personal connection, talk about what the research can do. So that initial phase is more of the trust building phase. And we have a what should I say, a primary scientific question, which is, how does a gene called APOE4 influence the risk of Alzheimer's disease in native populations? So just taking a step back, APOE4, I kind of say that word as APOE4. How does APOE4 influence the risk of Alzheimer's? APOE4 is the most significant genetic risk factor for Alzheimer's. It's found in over half of patients with Alzheimer's disease, at least in the United States, Canada, and Western Europe. And it has an influence on whether you benefit from new Alzheimer's drugs. In fact, if you have two copies, you don't tend to benefit at all. It's also employed in preventative medicine. So you can get a saliva swab that will tell your APOE4 status, and that can tell your future risk for dementia. Some of the new Alzheimer's blood tests also use APOE4 to boost the accuracy of those tests. And if you've got a copy of APOE4, you're more likely to get a positive result. So APOE4, it's used increasingly as part of Alzheimer's personalized medicine. The problem, though, is that we've learned more and more recently that APOE4 has different effects depending on the population you're looking at. So for one, APOE4 is found at different rates in different geographies around the planet. So some of the highest rates of APOE4 are found in Scandinavia and sub-Saharan Africa. Some of the lowest rates are found around the Mediterranean basin and the Tigris and Euphrates River regions. It's actually one of the hypotheses, not to go kind of too tangential here, is that APOE4 may actually help with early life survival in environments where nutrition is scarce, but it may come at the price of causing Alzheimer's disease later in life. And so societies like around the Mediterranean basin and in the Middle East that have had civilization for much longer may have essentially not needed APOE4 around. Whereas Scandinavia, where it's very hard to grow pretty much anything, maybe that gene was, again, helping with early life nutrition, but again, at the cost of late life dementia. And then the other issue is that the APOE4 gene has different effects on increasing the risk for Alzheimer's in different populations. And so, if you're East Asian and you have an APOE4 gene, you're at the highest risk of Alzheimer's of any other population known to date. If you're from Scandinavia, you may have kind of an intermediary risk for Alzheimer's if you have APOE4. If you're African American, you actually have a slightly attenuated risk. That means that your risk is a little bit lower, basically, than the East Asian and the European, 100% European populations. Caribbean Hispanics have also been studied, and they have some of the lowest risks of Alzheimer's if they have APOE4. So the question that we had was, what about Native Americans? Native Americans are basically not part of the Alzheimer's research discussion. There's a group at University of Washington that, in my opinion, is doing fantastic work, and they're contributing to this area. But overall, it's still very much a little explored area of science. So our question is, how does APOE4 influence Alzheimer's, which with implications on the accuracy of blood tests, on whether the information you get from an APOE genetic test is accurate or not. And of course, these new Alzheimer's drugs where APOE4 status makes a big difference on your future risk of getting it. So that's our main question. And we are finding evidence that APOE4 really doesn't play much of a role at all in increasing the risk for Alzheimer's in native populations. So We don't know what that is yet, but it looks like there's some sort of protective factor with native populations that's preventing the normal bad effect of APOE4 on Alzheimer's disease. And one of the long-term goals of our study is not only to address health disparities in personalized Alzheimer's medicine, but also how can we understand APOE4 through the lens of this underexplored population to unlock some of its secrets and develop better diagnostics and therapies for Alzheimer's disease.
So, what is it that made you want to be an ally for Native Americans in their brain health? What drew you to specifically Native Americans? There's a gazillion other cultures that you could have picked and of other peoples that you could have picked. Why them?
Yeah, so again, I would point to some of my mentors who really got me started in this project. Neil Henderson, Anna Marie Hill, they're both at University of Minnesota. Neil Henderson's now a professor emeritus. But you know, it's funny how your personal relationships with people and kind of the discussions that you have and the ideas that you have can, you know, get you started on these projects. And Neil Henderson is a pioneer in the area of APOE4 and Alzheimer's disease in native populations. He was actually one of the first to publish on this area back in the 90s. And after coming out of training, I was struck by how little representation there was from native communities in Alzheimer's research. I think at the time, out of about 45,000 people in the Alzheimer's disease research centers, these are kind of the main Alzheimer's research going on in the United States. About 88 were Native American, and none of those had genetic data. So we're at kind of square one in regards to, okay, we really have no information on this. And we're talking about how can we make this happen. Again, he really kind of got me up to speed on how we build these relationships and, you know, how we do the science and how we create community partners. And for me, I also enjoy, again, I think that goes back to the reason I went into this field. You know, you have to get to know people. That's why I went into the field of dementia, because unlike a lot of other medical specialties where it's a checklist approach, I feel like we have to really get to know people. And I think working with Native communities, you know, it's a prerequisite that you have to get them to know you, and you have to get to know them, and you have to actually have a personal relationship. And for me, that's very rewarding. You know, I like looking at research papers and looking at data. But what really kind of makes me feel rewarded is feeling like, yeah, you're part of a team, and you have people that you support and that they support you, and you get to celebrate your mutual successes, and you get to, you know, feel like you're something beyond just yourself. You know, that's, you know, what this project really gives me, and I'm very thankful to be part of it.
You, in our last conversation, talked about how the American Brain Foundation, the American Academy of Neurology, the Alzheimer's Association have been big supporters in funding your research. I'm curious, like people like myself, my average listener, how do we contribute? Can we contribute to those organizations to keep the research funding pipeline flowing? Is that a possibility?
Yeah, no, I definitely think that contributing to the American Brain Foundation is something that has real world impact, and that again will keep the, as you said, the pipeline of researchers going, because again, that really is where researchers look when they're just out of training or at the end stage of their training, and they're saying, "Hey, I want to address a research question, but again, I need that runway." Again, major federal agencies are not there to do that. You really do need places like the American Brain Foundation to, you know, lay out that space where they can have time to develop the research questions, have resources to collect some preliminary data, also network too. You know, the American Brain Foundation provides amazing networking where you're given the ability to meet with leaders in the field who can guide you and mentor you through. You know, research is always unpredictable. You never really know what's going to happen. And you need someone who can tell you, hey, you've come up on this roadblock. Here's what I recommend you do. American Brain Foundation gives trainees that in spades. So yeah, I think it's again something that I'm tremendously grateful for, and that I 100% would not be here today if it weren't for the American Brain Foundation. So yeah, I personally donate so that other trainees can have the experience I had. As to how to donate, I'm more of an online person, so I'm not familiar with other routes, but I get a reminder on my American Academy of Neurology Society renewal that there are these sources that can help with making sure brain science keeps moving forward.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We are about out of time for today, but I want to talk a little bit more about cures and more about promising research. And thank you for what you shared today about preventing dementia. And that was very helpful for me. And it was also very inspiring because in our first conversation, I felt like, oh Lord, this is depressing. But in this conversation today, it was good to know that there can be lifestyle changes to prevent it and all of those kinds of things. So thank you for putting a little hope in my heart today. I
Yeah,
appreciate
there is
that.
hope.
You up for another conversation?
Yes, yeah, I'd love to.
Thank you again, Will. I appreciate you spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. Be sure that you subscribe and share. You can get more leadership learning from my YouTube channel and by following me on Instagram. Reach out when you're looking for a speaker to energize your next event. Reach out when you need curated leadership learning for your organization. Reach out when you're ready for consulting that will help your organization fulfill its potential. I'm Joanne Smichel, and thank you for tuning in.